For questions, if you wait for Carl with a microphone, and if you want to just pick who you want.
Yeah. Oh, yes, sir.
Yes, I'd like to know if I read your most of your book, and I'd like to know if you discovered any additional documentation to substantiate your point since the book has been published. If you've been able to get any of the material that, according to the book, you were denied access to by the Department of Justice and other individuals in the current Clinton administration.
Yes, the FBI, the Department of Justice, will not release the information on the arrival of the spy on March 27th, 1941. Jan Arino, the Attorney General, has labeled this the highest classification of our government. It's a B-1 national defense secret. That's 60 years ago. They won't even tell me the dates of these messages or what's it all about. They won't even tell me the file number, the FBI file number. But I got this from them because I had asked for the any information they have in late March 1941 on the Japanese steamship, the Nita Maru. And the Nita Maru is the one that brought him to Pearl Harbor. So we know it's, somehow it's got to do with the arrival of the Nita Maru and the spy. And this today is a B-1 national defense secret, the highest classification the Department of Justice has. And I appeal personally to the Attorney General and to her public relations man, Carl Stern, who is former NBC Supreme Court reporter. And he filed many FOIAs when he was with NBC News, but he would refuse to release this to me under my FOIAs. But the Navy Department has been a lot better. They have released these documents, which that's what I found in July 1995. And Admiral McCollum's memo was released to me. And then last week, you asked, I was in Washington, D.C., and the Navy has released more information. And this information confirms even more overwhelmingly that we had broken the Japanese Navy codes as of November 16th, 1941. And this is at Station Cast in the Philippines. They had, the commander there said that we were intercepting them, decoding them, and translating the messages. So these are all the messages that are coming in saying that the Japanese carrier fleet's gonna refuel in the North Pacific. It's just astounding that that they were able to keep all of this secret for so long from Congress. You know, there was a congressional investigation in 1995, and none of this was shown to Congress even 5 years ago. Over here, please.
Thank you. How far do you believe President Roosevelt wished to go? For example, was an imminent threat of attack at Pearl Harbor adequate to his purposes, or do you believe that he actually wanted to see the bombs fall on Pearl Harbor? For example, there was the message that went through the Navy Department, apparently, that did arrive several hours late. Do you believe that message was purposefully sandbagged?
Yes, well, the president was following Commander McCollum's memo. The president adopted this strategy, this overt act of war strategy, as a way to get to overcome the isolation movement. That's the important part of that. That's the smoking gun of Pearl Harbor, is this overt act of war. Because, as I said, the Americans didn't want anything to do with the European war. But as McCollum says, that if we do these eight things, then he predicted that this would create the ado. This is his word right there, that would unite the country. And it did. As you all know, on December 8th, the millions of Americans went to recruiting stations, Marine and Army and Navy, and joined the various services. And civilians went to work and produced this huge war machine that we defeated, really, Hitler, who was the main target. Let's see. Mr. Walker?
Two things. I don't, first of all, understand the logic behind General Marshall alerting the press. What would be the need for that? The other part is, couldn't the same propaganda aim by Roosevelt have been accomplished if they'd had discrete air defenses and actually had a trap for the Japanese and downed a bunch of planes? We could have still had the public outcry and upset.
Yes, that's a question that many ask me about. Why wasn't there some other option that the president could have done? But you see, they wanted a clean-cut, clear act of war, overt act of war that would unite the country. This is what they saw that was needed to bring the country together. Charles Lindbergh was our great hero, and 80% of the people followed him. Stay out of Europe's war. The other option would have been some have suggested that we could have attacked the Japanese fleet in the North Pacific, but they didn't want that. They wanted, because it could have been seen that we started the war. They wanted a clean-cut act of war, overt act of war.
No self-defense at all.
That was not, you know, that was not in this plan.
And why alert the press?
Well, you know, that hasn't really been discussed. I found that in General Marshall's papers, and there should be a debate in the journalism schools, and I am going to be speaking to some later on this year, and I hope to bring this subject up. But as you know, there was this, as I said, until Gary Hart said, follow me, the press looked the other way. And this was in, what, 1986 or so, something like that? Yes, sir.
I'm not satisfied with your answer. Why accept such a crushing defeat? It's almost as if you would have to claim that they could foresee that 6 months later at the Battle of Midway, the tide would be turned. If we had lost the Battle of Midway, if the Yorktown Hornet and Enterprise had been sunk instead and Midway taken and Hawaii threatened, maybe we would have had a peace movement in 6 months. So what's, I mean, other than pure cynicism, which I wouldn't put past them, what is the justification for accepting a catastrophic military disaster? Just to say that an overt act of war, that doesn't explain it.
Well, these are the words of Commander McCollum, and I'm the messenger bringing this to you. And this is what was adopted by the president because he saw the Americans were not reacting to the German attacks in the North Atlantic that I mentioned earlier. This was sort of probably a desperation move, you might you could argue, but the proof. Happened, and on December 11th, Adolf Hitler declared war on the United States. I should point out to you also that when President Roosevelt asked for a state of war exist, that was the same wording that Japan used when they declared war. That's not the accurate statement. They said a state of war exists between Japan and the United States, and so the parliament in Japan adopted the same wording. Someone in the back, you sir?
Earlier in your research, did you expect to find a smoking gun evidence as incriminating as the general's letter? Do you have some thoughts about why it wasn't destroyed so that nobody would find it?
That's a good. No, you asked, did I expect to find this? No. I started my quest on this project. I had read a book called At Dawn We Slept by Gordon Prang. It's a very fine book about the attack. And in that book, he mentioned just sort of a throwaway line that the Navy was intercepting Japanese naval messages in Pearl Harbor. Well, that was the first I'd read about that. This was in 1982. And I thought, well, that would be very interesting to check it out. I was on the Oakland Tribune staff at the time, told our editor, Bob Maynard, that I thought this might be worthwhile for our December 7th, 1982 Pearl Harbor story. You know, all newspapers do that. And he said, fine, go. And so I filed an FOIA at the time at the Navy to see this station HIPO. This was the monitor station on Hawaii. And then the space still existed. The Navy did let me in. I was the first U.S. newsman to get into this station. and this was in September 1982, but I learned that in August, the Japanese crew from NHK had beaten me there, and they got the scoop on that. But what I wanted to do, I wanted to learn about how we were intercepting the Japanese naval vessels when I was there in 1944, because we were always told we were we learned about them from sighting by our submarines. So this gave me an edge up. And so I met the cryptographers, the radio men that were intercepting these messages. I had, that was what I was interested in. And I filed FOIAs to get these messages. And lo and behold, when I got the message, the first batch out of a million of them that were that are in the process of being released, the first 6,000 included this explosive, really smoking gun of Pearl Harbor. It's remarkable. And you'd ask, why weren't these destroyed? Well, it's almost like the Nixon tapes. Why didn't he destroy them? I don't know what the explanation is. Perhaps they were forgotten, because when I opened them, the dust, you could tell I was probably the first one to see these maybe in 50 or so years. Another one from the rear, back over there. Yes, sir.
Thank you. First, I have a statement. I think your book moves the debate from did he do it to why he did it. The other thing is that how large is this conspiracy? Was this conspiracy? How many people were involved, such as McCollum? In other words, what do you think the total number of people was? And the second question, do we look at Japan's culpability in the war in a different light now?
Yes, you asked about how many knew. I've identified approximately 30 members of the Roosevelt administration, and of course the president, and Arthur McCollum, Captain, or later on, Rear Admiral Anderson, General Marshall, and the other people in the communications intelligence field there in Washington. I have no evidence that anybody in Pearl Harbor, any of the active commanders there, outside of that gatekeeper, the intelligence gatekeeper that kept the control on the FBI, that was Admiral Walter Anderson, and he's in my book and the picture. Let's see, the other question was on
Japan's culpability. Can we look at it differently now, Japan's culpability?
Oh, yes, Japan. And I've asked attorney friends of mine, what about this? And they said, well, Japan didn't, their militaries didn't have to act on these provocations, but in the same way, if Japanese warships had come into Puget Sound, that would have antagonized this country. And we'll soon know, because my book is going to be published in Japan later on this year, and we'll get some reaction from the Japanese. The far back there.
Yes, Mr. Sinnett. I wonder, the reluctance of State Department to release information might have something to do with a possible collusion by British and Dutch intelligence interests.
The State Department records are the easiest ones to get. They're diplomats, so they don't think in the terms of, say, military and police, FBI, that this is our information, we're not going to give it to you. The State Department were not really in the communications intelligence loop, because they were talkative, and the communications people didn't want to share it with the State Department. But there was a liaison between the British units in Singapore and the Netherlands in Batavia, which was then called the Netherlands East Indies. It's now Indonesia. So, please.
This is a great presentation. Thank you. I'm wondering if talking about who's involved, these 30 people that you named or who you said might be involved, General McCarthy sat in the Philippines with a message, an encrypted message, knowing that Manila was and Clark Air Force Base was going to be attacked within 18 hours, it was, and he did nothing. Was he part of this knowledge?
Yes.
Well, prior knowledge?
Yes. Well, General MacArthur, as I pointed out to you, received the order from President Roosevelt to stand aside, just remain in a defensive posture, and let Japan commit the first overt act of war. And that's what he did. And he replied to the order saying that everything is ready for a successful defense. See, General MacArthur was a public relations expert. He was head of the Army. He was chief of staff of the Army during the 1934. And so he knew Washington. He knew what Washington wanted. And then when Admiral Hart, who was the commander of the U.S. Asiatic Fleet, got that order, he ordered all of his submarines to submerge in Manila Bay instead of attacking the Japanese troop ships that were coming and invading the Philippines. So the whole idea was to follow the order, let Japan commit the first overt act of war. And General MacArthur, it was on December the 3rd, he started a rushed airstrip in Mindanao, the southernmost part of the Philippines, so that he could escape by B-17s. And he took his key staff members, including his cryptologists and the radio people that were supplying this information, and they all escaped. But he left General Jonathan Wainwright at Bataan, and we all know what happened at Bataan.
I wonder if you could give me a little bit more in-depth reason why you tell us that it was to unite the country. Roosevelt did this to unite the country because it was against war. Beyond that reason, was it economic? Was it ego? I want to know more why they would do this incredible thing to people of their own country.
Well, as Prime Minister Churchill said in that newsreel clip, we were on the abyss. We were sinking deep, both Britain and the United States. We did not have a two-ocean navy at that time. And Hitler, had he invaded England and seized the British fleet, would have been terrible danger to our country. And there is a preamble to Commander McCollum, it's not here, but I do have it in the book, and he goes into all the reasons why Hitler posed this danger. But you see, it was that isolation movement. You can't believe how powerful it was, led by America's greatest hero. He was a bigger hero than John Glenn is today. Charles Lindbergh was just worldwide, had tremendous influence in this country.
How about over here?
All right, yes, go ahead.
And I'd like leave to ask a couple of questions, because I've read as much about Pearl Harbor and the Pearl Harbor attack as you have, and I have the 40 volumes. I've read the 40 volumes. I'm sorry. Do I get it closer? Okay. First of all, do you have any evidence that Lieutenant Commander McCollum's formulation over there was ever seen by Franklin D. Roosevelt?
Yes. There are eight actions. Every one of those has he either issued an executive order, or in the pop-up cruises, the White House testimony in February and March and in spring and November, all revolves around his approving pop-up cruises.
Let's talk about the pop-up cruises, okay? You're calling the visits by American cruisers to Australia or to Singapore somehow or other antagonizing the Japanese. But now, certainly, two cruisers in the Bungo Suido would be antagonistic. Now, what are the names of those two cruisers?
Those cruisers have not been released as yet. This is based.
You've got access to all the smooth deck logs.
No,
just two questions.
No, we have the deck logs of the two of the pop-up cruises that went to the Central Pacific. That included one was the Salt Lake City. Was the flagship of that cruise, and then where they went is all whited out. But if you hold it up to the whiteout, you can see where they went. Now, the third one that I've been able to document is from Japanese sources, who said that at least two cruisers invaded the Bungo Strait. This is the body of water that leads into the inland sea. And they filed a complaint with the U.S. Ambassador there in Tokyo, as I recall. But you've asked what are the names of those cruisers. Those have not been released. I have not found them. But I hope that in, out of these million records that we will surface.
Let me ask another question. You maintain that Admiral Yamamoto broke radio silence during the approach to Pearl Harbor. Admiral Yamamoto was sitting on his battleship at Kure Navy Yard. He was directing all of Japanese naval operations. He could not break radio silence. When he spoke, and it was broadcast on at least three radio stations at any one time. It was the striking force, the Kido Butai approaching Pearl Harbor, that's the one that had to maintain radio silence, and it did. Your theories to the contrary notwithstanding.
Well, I appreciate your, but you haven't seen these documents in Navy archives there in Washington, D.C. Well, if I could finish here, please. You said Admiral Yamamoto did not break radio silence. On December the 2nd, using his radio call sign YOWI00, he sent a message to the entire Japanese Navy, said, Ni'i Taka Yamanobori. That was a hidden code word to climb Mount Ni'i Taka on December the 8th. And this was intercepted in Hawaii, was not given to Admiral Kimmel or General Short. The Japanese Army also had a hidden code word phrase, and it was called the black kite and eagle will fly on December the 8th. Of course, that was in Japanese. That was also intercepted. And the Japanese Foreign Ministry had a hidden word code where they'd notified all of their overseas missions. It was called the East Wind Rain Code, though there's some doubt whether that particular wording was sent out, but the point is that each of these Japanese ministries had a hidden word code that could be reached their far-flung missions and didn't need cryptographers or expert radio men to encode. That's why they had a hidden word code. You, sir?
Yes. What do you think would be the consequences had the Japanese not attacked Pearl Harbor? That is, that this event had not occurred. What do you think the outcome of the war would have been?
Well, because that would be like a what-if book, you know. And what-if books are very popular, and I'm sure someone should, you know, I think that would sell, and somebody should come up with a what-if it had not done that.
You studied it. Why don't you take it on?
Well,
crack at it.
It's my hands are full just following this communications intelligence, and I want to even get more on it, but to find out why they didn't, you have to read what Commander McCollum said. We have to create the ado, and Pearl Harbor was the ado. Yes, sir.
Yeah, two things very briefly. First, a comment. I had a brother-in-law who was in Pearl Harbor on a destroyer when it was being bombed, and his destroyer sank that Japanese submarine when it was getting out of harbor.
Yes.
That's part one. Part two, some years ago, I read a book by John Tolan called Infamy.
Yes.
And in it, he made reference to information very much along the lines of yours that he mostly got from an individual named Robert Ogg that he only identified as Seaman Z.
Yes.
Did you have any chance to follow up with that?
Yes, I interviewed Commander Ogg is still alive. He lives here in California. And he was a specialist in the Naval Intelligence Office in San Francisco, and he worked in communications intelligence in a way, though he was mainly bugging the Japanese consulate, but he understood radio navigation, so he was asked by the head of intelligence there in San Francisco to plot these intercepts of the Japanese carrier fleet that was proceeding from Hitokapu Bay in the North Pacific and then down to Pearl Harbor. And a huge storm on November 30th scattered the ships. Admiral Nagumo, who was the commander of the carrier fleet, had to call the ships back together and had to use radio. He couldn't use the blinker system you've seen on ships where they have old lights that could flash like a da-da-da-da-da-da. But anyways, so they broke radio silence. He used low power, but at the same time, this huge storm, there was a sunstorm that disrupted communications in the world and bounced these messages all over the United States to San Francisco, where Mr. Ogg plotted these intercepts on a map of the North Pacific, showed where they were. They could identify the warships by their unique Japanese communication procedures. Radio direction finder, Dutch Harbor, located them there, and as well as here on the West Coast. And the SS Lurline also heard them. There's someone here from Matson, I think. Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, we haven't gone back here.
Yes. The end results of the deception was successful. That we don't have to figure about. But in the case of propaganda and trying to lead a situation, would you say that the deception was necessary, perhaps, and that it, in fact, saved lives in the long run, considering where Hitler was at? So it's like a double deception. You're deceiving the enemy, but in the process, you're going to deceive some of your own people if you're at a certain position. But the results, I think, were successful.
Yes. Well, this use of deception, other historians have told me about the Gulf of Tonkin, in the Vietnam War, that possibly would have been another provocation. This is all hearsay as far as I'm concerned. I'm not checking that. But many people have thought that the Gulf of Tonkin resolution was a way to get us into the Vietnam War. I'm told also that President Lincoln provoked South Carolina militia at Fort Sumter. And I'm also told that President Polk provoked the Mexican military in the Mexican War in, what is it, 1846, 48, in there. But this is all hearsay. But this provocation is probably goes back to Julius Caesar time. Yes, sir.
You mentioned that Janet Reno, that they're still classifying some of this data.
It's B1 National Defense Secrets.
Can you speculate on the motivation for that by the present administration?
It's just, I don't understand why they're doing that, except maybe it reveals some communications intelligence features that we're using today that they don't want out. But you know, that's ridiculous, because we have spy satellites now, though basically it's probably the same. But I don't know. It's another what if type, and it would be very interesting to do that. Can we get someone in the middle down over here? You, sir?
Yes, I have a question about the 5-digit code that you refer to
yes.
in your book. Was this in fact the JN-25 code?
I'm glad you raised that question. You have to be sort of sophisticated to know about what you said, JN-25 code. That is the Japanese operation code that was used in 1941 to organize the Japanese Navy to attack Pearl Harbor. And the important messages went out over this code system, which the Japanese called Code Book D. But we did not call it JN-25 in 1941. We called it the 5-number code. And Congress and the in various presidential administrations and the Navy have encouraged Americans to believe this JN-25 was not solved until 1945 and 46. And you have to be sophisticated to understand that was not even used, that designator was not used in 1941. It was called the 5-number code, and it was first used by Japan in 1939. It was immediately recognized as a military code, and they worked on it, and they first solved it in February 1940. Japan changed it about every 6 months, but we broke it constantly. As I said earlier, in the Philippines, they said that we were intercepting, we were decoding, and we were translating the 5-number code.
And that was, in fact, the JN-25 series?
Well, we call it, but that's a way to sidetrack. Because if you look for JN-25 in 1941 records, you won't find it.
Okay. Was this then the same code that the U.S. Navy was reading during the Midway operation?
Yes. The code book D, Japan used it until just before Midway. But by that time, we knew where they were going, because they had to organize that fleet starting in March.
My question is then, at that time, this code, the U.S. was admitting that it had broken approximately 20% of the code groups, and it could read approximately 20% of the code groups. Therefore, it wasn't spelled out that Midway was the operation, but through a combination of code intercept, intelligence, etc. efforts, they figured out that it was Midway. But they had not, in fact, broken the whole code, which consists of code groups. They had figured out about approximately 20%. If this was the case in 1941 for Midway, or 42 rather, 6 months later, how could the U.S. have known that much about this five-digit code? In fact, it hadn't been fully broken. And in fact, there were intercepts, but they couldn't read them because they hadn't broken, they hadn't figured out what all the code groups meant.
Well, the evidence doesn't support your contention there. The evidence, the finest evidence that you can have, is the officer in charge at Station Cast in the Philippines. He wrote to Washington on November 16th and said, we are current in the current Japanese operation code. This is code book D. And he summarized some of these messages for President Roosevelt, quoting the Japanese ships, "We are leaving Korea, we're heading to the Philippines." So the evidence is just overwhelming there. Let's see, you, sir?
Yes, I'm curious. By the time this event occurred, the attack and the few months preceding it, France had been overrun. Vichy France was ostensibly, by that time, a Nazi ally. North Africa had the tragedy of the destruction of the French fleet by the British fleet in North Africa, exactly what you had said earlier, that the French fleet was in danger of falling into German hands, and had England fallen, not only the English fleet, but Canada and other possessions might have fallen. The French in Indochina were cooperating with the Japanese. All of these things were going on. If you had sat in the Oval Office at that time as an advisor to President Roosevelt, how would you have advised him on these eight suggestions here, please?
That's a top question. Everybody in the United States asks me that, and they want me to comment on it. I the only way I can answer it is that I think that was he had many options to use, but I think this action F was the realistic one that would unite this country. And I, of course, was alive at that time and was very much aware of the isolation movement. I saw the danger to Hitler. But going back, that option was the only logical one that he could use. Some people say that was the right thing to do. But then others say, how could you call that right thing when you put our men lives out on the line? Let's go over this side.
What was... What was McAuliffe's, is it McAuliffe?
McCollum.
What was his background that would give him the insight to be able to come up with that plan? I mean, how is it him that would come up
Excellent
with that plan?
Excellent question. He was born in Japan, a Baptist missionary parents. So he was born in Nagasaki. And stayed there until he was about 6 or 7 years old when his father died, and his family moved back to Alabama, I think it was. But he learned to speak Japanese before he spoke English, and played with Japanese children, knew their culture. He was there in Japan when Japan had the surprise attack at Port Arthur, where they seized Korea, defeated the Russian fleet in 1904, I think it was. So he knew the propensity for a Japanese surprise attack. He knew what would you know, excite the Japanese militarists there. All right, yes, let's go.
You go into a considerable technical detail about the RDF network and the intercept network, which is all very true. And there has been quite a bit written about the Enigma machine, or the Ultra efforts. Our name for it was Ultra, and our name for the Pacific was Magic. Was there ever any evidence uncovered other than some found code wheels at the embassy in Honolulu that gives any information about a Japanese code machine such as Hitler had? Or was it all done manually by the Japanese because of their unique language and use of katakana in the radio transmission efforts?
Yeah, the Japanese Navy did not use machine ciphers like the Enigma, which was a German machine cipher used by Hitler. And I have not really studied all that, but the Japanese Foreign Office used a machine cipher. It was called Purple. But Hawaii did not have the Purple machine, though they had it in Manila. So General MacArthur had access to it, and the message is going out over the Purple code, or saying, say to the Americans, don't tell them that we're going to break off negotiations, just string them along. This was on December 2nd. You know, even that should alert you. And I'm certain that it did. But, you know, the controlling policy, the strategy of our country was let Japan commit the first overt act of war, right out of McCollum. Let's see. Yes, sir.
American aircraft carriers were not in port. Was that accidental, or do you feel that was deliberate? Somebody had thought that out and knew that the aircraft carriers were what it would take to win the war and deliberately had them removed from Pearl Harbor?
Thank you. I did not speak of that. There were three aircraft carriers in the Pacific December 1941. One was in San Diego, and two were at Pearl Harbor. But about a week before Pearl Harbor attack, the Washington, D.C. ordered the two carriers, that was the USS Enterprise and the USS Lexington, and their task groups to deliver aircraft to deliver 12 Army pursuit planes to Wake and 12 to Midway. So these task forces and their cruisers and attendant vessels, these were the most modern ships of our Navy, left Pearl Harbor. So what was left there were the old World War I battleships that could only go 18 knots. They could not keep up with carriers who go 30 knots. So what you had left in Pearl Harbor for the attack were just these relics of World War I. Our modern ships were out ostensibly to deliver these planes to Wake and Midway. The Admiral Halsey was in charge of the Enterprise, and he did deliver 12 planes to Wake, but the other vessel, the Lexington, did not deliver. It just sort of sailed around in the Central Pacific there and never did deliver the planes to Midway. So I think that was a ruse just to get the most modern ships out and just leave the old beat-up battleships for Japan's attack. And, you know, Japan did not attack our oil supply on Oahu, didn't attack the electric grid on Oahu. That would have been terrible damage to us. They just went after these old wrecks of relics of World War I. Yes, sir?
That action F there, keeping the fleet at Pearl Harbor, do you believe that the idea there was to provide a tempting target, or was this supposed to be a threat? The other actions there seem to be threats, you know, do something that makes the Japanese afraid of us, whereas what actually happened was that it provided a tempting target. Now, which, do you think that's what they were trying to do, a tempting target, or just one more threat?
No, I think that was what Commander McCollum had in mind as the tempting target to the Japanese militarists who were enraged by being cut off from their oil. They had no place to go. And so keeping the fleet there at Pearl Harbor was a provocation that easily fell into the Japanese militarists' hands. And normally the fleet was based on the West Coast. There was no such thing as the Pacific Fleet in 1940 when this called the Hawaiian Detachment, as I recall. It was just a small number of warships there. So President Roosevelt ordered Admiral Richardson to keep the fleet there over the Admiral's objection. As I said, the Admiral refused to do it. It was a knockdown, drag-out name-calling there in the Oval Office on October 8th. And President Roosevelt fired Admiral Richardson and put in Admiral Kimmel. Somebody down in the middle there? Right there, good sir.
You've had some deservedly good reviews from the part of the historians and that. Have you had anything from the military who were there at the time or were in the service at the time, senior officers and that sort of thing, with regard to your book?
The news book reviews of it have been 70% approval of the revelations. This includes the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, San Diego Union, San Francisco Chronicle, Denver, Detroit. Also, you can gauge a reaction on the internet, because Amazon.com, which is a big bookseller, and also Barnes & Noble have internet sales, and they people can comment on them. I have also about a 70% approval rating on there. Now, there's about 30% people who disagree in various aspects in my book. Some of them appear to be from the military. I call them the Pearl Harbor establishment because they all seem to say the same thing, the same position. But you're not going to, there's always going to be people be doubted this. Some people say that, there was no such thing as an isolation movement in 1940. That's just ridiculous. I think upstairs I have a full-page enlargement. The Brooklyn Eagle has an 8-column double-deck headline quoting Charles Lindbergh, that we want nothing to do with Hitler's war and let's sign peace for him. Someone else, way back there.
Yes, just by accident, we happened to meet a relative of Admiral Kimmel. He lives in Hayward, actually, and we said we were coming here, and he bristled because he said his uncle had been a scapegoat. That did we know, he was really upset to say this because his family's name had been disparaged all these years, that when FDR was Secretary of the Navy, I believe, that apparently the Admiral had some encounters with FDR and was somewhat on the outs. So I wondered why he was appointed as a replacement for Admiral Anderson, because his name has been a symbol for gross negligence, perhaps. I don't know if you've ever followed up on any of this aspect with the family, but...
Well, yes, I have talked to Admiral Kimmel's brother, and of course they didn't know all of this information. This communications intelligence was withheld from Admiral Kimmel, so he never really thoroughly discussed this. Though, as you say, he had contact with President Roosevelt when he was Assistant Secretary of the Navy in 1914. But, you know, that they certainly wouldn't have been talking communication telling. And in 1914, there was no such thing as radio. But the Kimmel family have asked Congress to restore his rank as full admiral, you know, four-star admiral. And the Senate last year, in May of last year, did vote on a very close vote, 53-47, to recommend that President Clinton restore Admiral Kimmel and General Short to their pre-war ranks. That action is still waiting in the House, but if it dies in the House this session, then it'll have to start all over again, I'm told. Way in the back there.
This is a follow-up on Admiral Kimmel. And in the early 1950s, I remember Captain Theobald, we didn't give much credence to what he was trying to say. He was making
what I saw was the first allegations about all of this has been, but it never, he never had the ammunition or the firepower or the guts or whatever to follow up with it. That was Theobald. He was a cruiser commander in World War II in the South Pacific, and Kimmel was his friend, and he was attempting to open it up. What you've done, of course, is what he was attempting to do. What happened to Theobald, and did he just give up on his attempts?
Well, all of this information was locked in Navy vaults. Even Life magazine in September 1945 had a major story pretty much suggesting that this was a backdoor approach to war, but there was no proof. And so anyone like Admiral Theobald or Life magazine or anybody else brought this up, they were accused as a political tirade against the dead president, because he died in April 1945. And so politics entered that. And the war euphoria, we had won. People just didn't want to hear that now. Way in the back there.
Did you find any hints in your research that there might have been other setups of Americans by our government on American soil, such as maybe the strangely ominous Fort Chicago blast of 1944, things like that?
Oh, my research is all really essentially pre-December 7th, 1941. I have not gone into any other records, so all I know what I found in communications intelligence, and that would be involving Japanese and Port Chicago, would not be in this channel. I thank you all very much. I'll be upstairs to sign books for you.
I want to thank Bob Stinnett for taking the time to join with us, and also for the really remarkable work that he's done. This has been an effort that others, Theobald was mentioned, others have attempted to do, and there's still a lot to be learned, obviously, not just about Pearl Harbor, but about many other aspects of government policy. That's a lot of what the Independent Institute is involved in. So I think Bob deserves our special thanks for the work he's done in producing this book. For those of you who have copies and they've not been autographed, as you mentioned, he'd be happy to autograph them. He can do it right here, actually. For those of you who don't have copies, I believe there's some still upstairs, and if we have run out, or if we do run out, we'd be happy to take orders and ship them to you right away. So I want to thank everyone for joining with us and making this a very successful event. We hope that you'll join with us next time. Good night, and thank you.
Thank you.